You're listening to Write the Book, the podcast for writers and curious readers coming from Burlington, Vermont. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear an interview with Vermont author Castle Freeman, Jr., whose novel, The Devil in the Valley, came out this week as a paperback from Overlook Press. Castle Freeman, Jr. is the author of four other novels, including All That I Have and Go With Me, two collections of short stories, and many essays and other nonfiction. His stories have been mentioned or included in Best American Short Stories and other major collections. Go With Me was made into a movie in 2008. Castle Freeman lives in southeastern Vermont. Here's some information about The Devil in the Valley. In his quiet Vermont home, a man named Taft, dispirited, ex-teacher, ex-scholar, ex-abstainer, sits alone, except for a bottle of Sir Walter's scotch, and wonders what's missing from his life. He's at a loss until a voice startles him from the rocking chair, where a stranger has appeared, seemingly out of nowhere. He's well-dressed, smooth-talking, proves to be a devilishly charming drinking partner, and he offers Taft the chance to have anything he's ever wanted for a price. So begins The Devil in the Valley. Placed in Freeman's classic setting of a dark, moody, rural Vermont, this beguiling tale touches on temptation and greed and all the things we desire for ourselves and for others in this life. A captivating story that explores the supernatural while staying rooted deeply in our world. The Devil in the Valley is a seductively powerful novel, as bewitching as Old Nick himself, from a master of his craft. When I spoke with Castle Freeman, I asked him to begin by talking about how he came to write The Devil in the Valley.
Well, I'd always, for years, wanted to do a kind of send-up of the Faust story in rural New England terms. And I toyed with that idea for years, and then I finally got going on it when I reread Marlowe's play and discovered that although it is billed as a tragedy, as the tragical history of the life and death of Dr. Faustus, in fact, it's played for laughs from beginning to end.
Oh, wow.
Almost, and very often quite broad, low humor type laugh. Page after page of that sort of thing. So I'd read the play before, and I guess I didn't twig to that. And that gave me, that got me going, and I was able to figure out my own ways of capitalizing on the funny parts.
Yeah, and I have a question for you later about your humor in your work, but let's start with Dangerfield. And I know he's not necessarily the main character of the book, but I just loved him. He was, at first I took him to be the devil himself, but then I realized he's really more of an emissary.
He's an emissary. He's like in the play of Christopher Marlowe, the devil is Mephistopheles.
Right.
And he is a sort of a commissioned officer. He's not the devil himself, and neither is my guy.
Okay, I'm going to have to read that play now.
It's wonderful fun. It's a great play.
Yeah. Well, now, so Dangerfield is funny and he's slick. He's he likes to wear situation appropriate clothing, which I found hilarious. It was always fun to see what he was going to wear in each scene. And I also loved his name. You know, he's kind of a field worker and he's most definitely dangerous. So I wondered if you could talk a little bit about developing his character and how does he differ maybe from what you were working from with Marlowe?
Oh, well, Dangerfield is in the play is a kind of a huckster. He's a slicker.
Yeah.
And he his humor comes from that. He comes from the contrast between his vocabulary and his style of speech and what he is. He's supposed to be this principle of evil, but in fact, he's a huffler.
Yeah, yeah, and he's a fairly affable guy in some ways.
Affable guy, yeah, he is, and he's certainly got a sense of humor.
Yeah.
And he works for a very old established firm, of course,
right,
that he's very conscious of and works with his boss and other assistants to put the program over.
Yeah, and I really liked that line, we're a firm. You know, I like the depiction of hell as a corporate entity. I thought that was awesome.
He said, we're big. We're really big. Resources, we've got them. In a way, he almost sounds like Trump, doesn't he?
Yeah, absolutely.
He predates Trump by months and years, obviously.
Right.
But sometimes, as I read this book again, sometimes as I read it over, in a way, there's a kind of an echo.
All right. Well, let's talk a little bit about Langdon Taft, who is, in fact, I think, your main character, more or less. You have a lot of characters, but he's the one that all of this action sort of revolves around, and he's the one who Dangerfield is there to visit. Can you talk a little bit about Langdon and how he came to you?
I've written other things about people like him who are in the country up here, but not of it exactly.
Right.
Close, but not the real deal. And that he's in that tradition. He's in tough shape as the book begins. He's depressed. He's idle. He's lonely. He's miserable.
Right.
And he seems to, according to the joke of the book, he gets past all this and is redeemed and saved by having the magical powers that he gets from Dangerfield and then uses for the good of his community. But as a matter of fact, it seems to me that all that is sort of an emblem or a symbol for the fact that he's saved by the community itself.
Yeah.
They're what get him going again.
Yeah.
Not any kind of supernatural power.
Exactly. And it's funny because he is being very generous with this power that's come his way. But it doesn't seem like the thing that gets him going is the feeling of superiority or being like the big guy who can help people out. You know,
yes. He's fairly humble. He's, as one of the other characters says, he wants to be of use.
Yeah.
Which is a modest enough ambition. But comes off pretty well in this book.
Yeah, I thought so too. And I also like the way that he, as things start out, he's kind of lost the respect of the community. And it's hard to be of use when people don't respect you or expect you to behave in a certain way.
Yes, but then he gets credit for that more and more, I think.
Yeah.
And the old woman who is Calpurnia.
Calpurnia.
Is a very important figure, obviously.
Yeah.
She spots his quality right from the beginning.
Yeah.
Likes him right from the beginning.
So, speaking of Calpurnia, there are a lot of characters in the book. You have a lot of point of view characters, and I wanted to ask if you enjoy working with a lot of different narrative voices.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I do. I enjoy making them up, and I enjoy manipulating them. That's part of the fun for me.
Now, this book is written in the third person. I would say it's probably a pretty close third person perspective. Do you ever write in the first person or do you tend? Yeah, you do.
Sure.
Oh, okay.
I have the book that preceded this one is in the first person. The book that succeeded this one is in the first person. Yeah, I get around quite a lot.
Now, tell me about the difference for you in working in third person or first person, if you can think of how that differs for you.
I think first person for me is more fun.
Oh, really?
And it's more limited, I suppose. But to me, that's fun. It's a question of getting the maximum effect out of a very disciplined approach.
Okay.
With a first person narrator, you get to get into his or her head.
Mm-hmm.
And you get to see the world through his or her eyes in a way that you don't with a third, I guess.
Right.
But it's all a first-person narrator has always seemed very natural to me.
Mm-hmm.
It's come very naturally to me.
Okay.
More perhaps in longer fiction like a novel than in short stories, which is what I mainly write.
Okay.
I think I'm less likely to write in the first person in short stories. Maybe not, but both.
Now, you just mentioned that a book succeeded this one, and I know this book is coming out in paperback in the next week or so. So what came after this?
My newest novel is provisionally called Old Number 5, and it's a story – about a sheriff in a rural Vermont community, similar to the main character in the novel that preceded Devil in the Valley, which is called All That I Have. Mm-hmm. In old number five, my agent is working on selling that in the U.S. So far, no thought. We may have a deal, however, to have it published in German.
Oh, interesting.
It's kind of strange to be published in German, but not in your own language.
Yeah.
I'll take it, I guess. That hasn't happened yet.
Okay, so it's written, but not yet out there.
Correct.
Okay. You set a lot of work in Vermont. This is, again, set in the state of Vermont. It's sort of your signature setting, is it? Or do you have other...
No, I write... It's really what has always interested me most, the culture, the setting, all of it. I have written other stories that were not set in Vermont. Sometimes they've been set in the Caribbean, let's see, in New York, in other places, but not often.
Right.
And very often when I have written stories that were set elsewhere, they kind of reflect back on here.
Okay. Because there's another association with Vermont in some way in the plot?
Yeah.
Okay.
Or someone who is in a distant place is from here.
Okay.
Or something.
Are you from here originally?
No.
No. Okay.
I was born in Texas during the Second World War. I grew up in Chicago. I went to school in New York and lived for a while in Philadelphia and came up here in the early 70s.
Okay. Well, that's a long time anyway.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, I've been here my adult life.
Yeah. We talked earlier about that great line about the firm. Another great line in this book that I absolutely loved is when Dangerfield points out to Langdon that the biggest problem with hell isn't the heat, but the time. We're talking eternity here, Chief, he says. And Taft replies, not worried about that either. I can last it. We're in Vermont, remember? For us, eternity is another name for March. I love that. The humor is great in the book. And as I said earlier, I do want to talk about the humor in your work. To me, it seems like another regional aspect. It seems very Vermont, your humor. So can you talk a little bit about how you use humor in your work? And do you always like to have some humorous aspect in your work?
Oh, absolutely, yes. I think that a humorist is mainly what I am now. Least I didn't used to be. I used to be a more serious fellow than I am now, but as a writer. But I guess age has made me a comic show, or so it seems. Because the humor of situations is always to the fore with me. It's very important, and this book is meant to be a good-natured, good-humored, funny book.
Not, it is.
Not funny so you're rolling on the floor and doing yourself an injury, but funny.
No,
like Dangerfield and his weird sub-corporate way of talking about things.
And, there's a certain point where he kind of takes a character to Hong Kong in just a moment's time. And then he, the character looks at him, and a minute ago he was dressed one way, and now he's dressed in Buddhist robes, you know.
Yeah, that's in a way a homage to Marlowe, because if you read Dr. Faustus, one of the supernatural things, because of the devil's help, is travel quickly to distant places. You know, in 1600, you couldn't get on a plane and go from London to Madrid or Rome. But the people in Dr. Faustus do that all the time.
Yeah.
And it's kind of more like another thing that was kind of inspired by Dr. Faustus, I guess, the source material.
Yeah. Okay. I wonder if we can address the idea of being careful. The story really talks a lot about being careful. Dangerfield is always advising Taft to be careful. And Taft at one point says that he comes from careful and prudent people.
Yep.
So what did you feel about the story lent itself to the idea of being careful?
I'm not really sure. I think the point with Dangerfield is that he's telling Taft to be careful lest Taft reveal that Dangerfield is there, because mm-hmm. he's invisible to everyone but Taft.
Right.
And so that's what careful means as far as Dangerfield is concerned. Now, what twisted part of my head that came out of, I don't really know. I suppose perhaps it's the setting. This is the tradition of this part of the country is a fairly careful people, prudent people, yeah. conservative people, perhaps. Maybe it goes with rural New England. I'm not sure.
Yeah. It struck me also that Taft is not necessarily going to play by the rules, even though they have this contract. He's not necessarily planning to play by the rules that Dangerfield has set out. And so the idea of being careful also could kind of reflect back to, you know, we're constantly being reminded that maybe Taft isn't gonna comply ultimately.
Yeah, maybe not. And that in Dr. Faustus, the man, and his devil, Mephistopheles, have the same kind of relationship in some ways. They aren't always on the same page.
Right.
And that's part of the humor of the play.
Yeah.
For me.
Yeah. Nowhere in the literature that I received or on the jacket of the book does it mention Faustus. Was that...
The epigraph of the book is from Dr. Faustus.
Oh, okay.
So if you get in there and check out the quote on the couple of pages before it begins, it's right out of Dr. Faustus.
Okay, because I did see online somebody said, you know, that this was your homage to that. But I was looking to see if it was mentioned in the jacket cover or anything, and it wasn't.
No, I guess the jacket copy didn't get into it. But,
yeah.
But certainly some of the reviews and articles and stuff.
Sure.
About it, mention it.
Yeah. Okay. Great.
And there is the epigraph, which that's always been an important part of the book to me. I always take note of quotes and epigraphs and that sort of material.
Yeah. I have to admit I don't remember the epigraph, and I usually love looking at those. So let me just see it. Oh, here we go.
You got it?
Yeah, I got it. But thinkest thou heaven is such a glorious thing? I tell thee, Faustus, it is not half so fair as thou or any man that breathes on earth. Great. That's great. Oh, I'm sorry I missed that.
that's the key to Faustus, I think.
Yeah.
That's a kind of a wonderful idea that is embodied in that short remark. I mean, he's kind of throwing the Middle Ages right out the window.
Mm-hmm.
Saying, don't worry about heaven, you know, worry about here.
Yeah.
Have your life as a human life.
I wonder if that was fairly controversial at the time.
I know. Christopher Marlowe was an interesting fellow.
Yeah. All right, let's talk a little bit more about your characters. Many of your characters are real characters in the sense that they're unique, they're interesting, they're a little bit funny or nutty. So do you find that you write your way into your characters, or do you sort of know, do you have an idea of who's going to be participating in this book as you start out?
No, I don't have much, I'm not much of a planner. I kind of get going.
Yeah.
And I got to have a premise, like in this case, the Faust premise.
Right.
But once I have that, I'm not much of a deliberator or a planner. I just Right. I write it.
Mm-hmm.
And then I obviously go over it, and I hope it take things out, put things in, et cetera, et cetera. But I don't sit down with a program of saying, okay, here are five characters, here's what's going to happen to them.
Yeah.
I sort of let the whole process discover itself.
Does that ever mean that you go off in the wrong direction? And if so, how do you rein yourself in? How do you know if something's working organically within what you're hoping to create?
I think it just sounds wrong. It sounds boring, or it sounds like it doesn't belong there.
Hmm.
I go pretty slowly, and I talk to myself, and I don't go badly wrong a lot, but sometimes I do, and then you just have to chuck it and start that part over again.
Have you ever chucked a whole manuscript?
No.
No?
I have a couple of manuscripts that nothing ever came of, in that they were never published.
Okay.
But they have been, I finish things, and then I hope for the best, but I never have abandoned a whole idea.
Okay. Now, you said that you sort of discover as you go. Do you have any sense of where you're going? Even if you don't know what the journey is going to be like, do you know what the end sort of looks like or not necessarily?
Yeah, in this case, certainly. Because the whole idea is Taft has made a deal with the devil, and when the appointed time is up, he's got to pay up. So there, the ending is pretty well set. In other books that I have written that aren't modeled on, or so strongly modeled on their particular corresponding work,
yeah,
I don't tend to know. No,
no.
Maybe in a very general way. I mean, if somebody's gonna die, maybe I know it. Uh-huh. But by and large, I don't really know how things are going to end.
And then do you have moments of epiphany where it sort of comes to you and you realize, yeah, oh my goodness, this thing is going to happen, and how awesome is that?
Yes, that's part of the great fun of doing this kind of work.
It is.
It's the stuff that you discovered along the way that you didn't know you knew.
Yeah.
that's quite mysterious to me.
It is.
And thrilling and wonderful fun.
I think that we're pretty good at making connections, and sometimes we have to ask the questions and then let them sit for a while, and then the connections will come to us, and we didn't even know we were working on them.
Oh, yes. I know sometimes it's happened to me. This is kind of an instance of that, I think. Not so much with novels, but with stories.
Mm.
I'm working away on one, and I've got it pretty well done, but the ending isn't right. Clearly, it's not right. But what's the matter with it? And very often, I've discovered that what's the matter with it is that the real ending was back three pages from the end, or maybe even right at the beginning. That's where it needed to end. And I didn't realize that, and so I followed a wrong path. But
interesting.
That's happened to me a number of times, and also with nonfiction, not essays. I mean.
Mm-hmm.
Not only with fiction.
So you might mistake the idea that you have for the beginning and put it at the beginning and realize later, really, this is the culmination of this.
Exactly. Yes. Yeah. And I suppose it could work the other way around. But
yeah.
it's sort of like you got the parts, but you don't have them in the right order.
Yeah. Do you ever cut stuff up and move it around? Or
Yeah.
I love the names that you choose for your characters. And I wonder, do you mind if I read a short section?
Mm-mm. Please.
All right, let me just find it. This is at the beginning of a chapter called Sorry for Cats.
Oh, yeah.
Pastor Chet Carter of the Valley Gospel Chapel told his flock that without the Lord, the condition of a man or a woman in this, our life, is utter solitude. We are born alone. We die alone, absent the Lord. He is present at our comings hither, and he is present at our goings hence. He and only he, thus the doctrine of Pastor Chet. Calpurnia Lincoln, said Pastor Chet, was full of it. Born alone, she said, nonsense. I love that. I love that section, and it really stood out to me that Pastor Chet's name is not a very biblical or important sounding name.
No.
And I love how his name itself sort of dismisses his ideology. Thus the doctrine of Pastor Chet. You know, it's just sort of like, it just sits there and says no.
Yeah.
Whereas Calpurnia, and I'm not going to get too into Calpurnia because I don't want to give anything away, but she has this very sort of important name, this Shakespearean name, right?
Right. Yeah.
And so we do sort of want to take her more seriously. She's got a serious name.
She's got a great name, yes. She's serious on two levels. And then there's also, in this book, I indulged my sense of humor, I guess, in creating names. I don't know if you spotted this or not, but the names of most of the characters are the names of the presidents of the U.S.
Yes, yes, yes.
The president, Lincoln.
Yeah.
I don't have a Washington, and I don't have an Obama, but I think I got most of the rest of them.
I think Obama would stand out in this cast.
Wouldn't sound right. But that was, I enjoy making up names of fictional people, but I needed here so many that I thought, rather than try to think up appropriate sounding names on my own, I would pick up this historical joke. And with Pastor Chet, it worked very well.
Yeah, that's great. Now, so of course, Carter and Taft and a lot of these names are Lincoln. But generally speaking, when you don't have that as your guiding principle, do you pick up phone books? Do you have, how do you source your names?
I've done phone books, yeah.
Yeah.
I just come up with ideas. I don't use the names of real people that I know.
No.
But phone books I have done, yes. Yeah. And other comparable sources, advertising.
I remember my sister graduated from a graduate program at MIT, and I went to the ceremony, and they had this massive, thick book for the graduation ceremony, because so many people were getting degrees that day. And I thought, this will be a great character source, right? So I took the book home, and then I'm looking through it, and I'm like, well, unless I'm going to really be writing about a lot of people who are from other places, you know, these names were so extremely distinctive.
Exotic.
Exotic, exactly. Yeah. Okay, your books tend to be short, and I think this has to do with your economy of words. This book, I think, is less than 200 pages.
Yeah.
No words are ever wasted, ever. And I wondered if we could talk about this. Do you draft short and then revise short, or do you draft long and then revise you know what I mean? Like,
yeah, I know exactly what you mean. I think I'm more likely to start short and then get a little bit longer.
Okay.
But where the shortness comes from with me, I guess, is just that I was taught that that's good writing, is concise and brief. I have written one novel that was respectable in length. It's 400 and some pages,
uh-huh.
titled My Life and Adventures. That was published 10 years ago.
Oh.
But since then, I've been under 200 pages.
And
this new one that I mentioned that hasn't got a publisher yet will be the same magnitude as this book.
Mm-hmm. Did it surprise you when the book came out at over 400, the other one?
Yeah. Because I'd written, that was my second novel. And the first one was more shorty, like these, although not as. But yeah, I was kind of stunned. God.
And it didn't feel like it was a mistake. It just didn't feel finished yet.
Oh, good. That's a very kind of diverse novel. It includes all kinds of non-novelistic, ostensible facts and tables. It even has tables and lists and stuff. So it should have been long was appropriate, I thought, if only because of its diversity.
Yeah. Okay. I want to talk a little bit about absurdity, and this I think it's related to your humor. But there's absurdity in this book, and I think in the other book that I interviewed you about, which was what was the other book that I interviewed?
Was that Go With Me.
I think it was Go With Me.
Yeah, it could have been. Yeah.
Is that the one with the kitchen scene on the cover with the man and woman?
No, that's All That I Have.
All That I think that's what it was then.
Yeah.
All That I Have. Same characters though, right?
Yes,
Go With Me.
No. The same characters in All That I Have are in this new novel that I've written.
Oh, but that was the first
working on. Go With Me is a different set of characters.
Oh, okay. All right. Do you mind if I read one more thing again?
Of course not.
Okay. Let's see. That's one thing I miss about this place is my dogs. Do you remember any of my dogs? I think that's Calpurnia talking.
Yep.
I remember your cat. I remember Snowflake. That's Eli, another character.
Yep.
Then Calpurnia says, Snowflake was a rabbit. He was Ruthie's rabbit. That was later. The cat was Snowball, but she wasn't mine. She lived in the barn. Before my time, says Eli. Long before, says Calpurnia. No, I never wanted a cat. Cats make me feel bad. Anyway, the sort of like the back and forth, and it's like, do you remember my dogs? I remember your cat. Snowflake. Yeah. No, Snowflake was a rabbit. He was Ruthie's rabbit. That was later. The cat was Snowbell, but she wasn't mine. You know, it's sort of like a who's on first kind of absurdity that's very fun.
But it's also, there's a certain realism to it. It's also, that's how people do. They sit around, they're not really talking about anything particularly important, but they bat it back and forth and they knock it around and they make fun of each other and they have a fine time.
Yeah.
And, that's the idea.
It is. It's fun. Okay. This sentence jumped out at me as I was reading the book, and I just had a feeling it was meant to be a very important sentence. You can correct me if I'm wrong. You beat the devil not by superior play, but by ignoring the game.
Oh yeah, that's an important line and an important idea to me, and Dangerfield then later calls him on that, and says this is not going to work.
Yeah, yeah.
We have a deal, and the fact that you decided you didn't like it, that's not going to make much difference.
Right. Yeah, I just felt like that was such a great line, and actually, what came to my mind. You mentioned Trump before, you know, his Twitter account and how yeah. people would try to out-tweet him. The absurdity of this is ridiculous. But anyway, people would try to out-tweet him. And I thought, you know, you beat that by not by superior play, but by ignoring the game. I mean, I think being ignored is how, you know, you get on Trump's nerves. So.
Yeah, exactly. And that seems to have gotten on Dangerfield's nerves.
Yeah, yeah.
Because if you can really void his whole program by ignoring it, then he's not really much of a devil, is he?
Right, yeah, that was great. Now, we were talking a minute ago about some of your other books. I read that Go With Me is now a film. So I wondered how that experience was for you
as the
author.
That was quite interesting.
Yeah.
Go With Me was, it got very good advanced reviews, very good early reviews, and I began to get calls, and my agent began to get calls from Los Angeles and people who were interested in film and TV rights. And I, as it happens, have a cousin who is in that business up there. And so he took it on as my agent, and finally, after a couple of years, it's a long and it's like herding cats getting done out there, but he did finally, and it was made into a movie. It came out about a year ago. It was has a marvelous cast. The hero of Go With Me is played by Anthony Hopkins.
Yeah, wonderful.
Ray Liotta. We have Julia Stiles. We have Hal Holbrook. We were all filmed up in the Pacific. I mean to say the Canadian Rockies,
uh-huh.
And was released down here about a year ago. It did have a theatrical release in the cities. It was never, I don't think it ever was in a theater in Vermont, but it was in Boston and New York, and now you can get it on Amazon streaming, whatever that means, and I guess it will be out on DVD. It's been released all over the world.
Wonderful.
And the process of having it made and being kind of a onlooker to the whole process was pretty interesting.
Did you go see any of the filming?
No, I didn't. We were, my wife Alice and I were invited to go out to the Canadian Rockies and visit the set and so forth, but this was in, I don't know, around this time of year, a couple of years ago, and mm-hmm. we figured you don't have to go to British Columbia to be cold and miserable. And,
when you can have it here.
Nobody, it was a complex and expensive trip, and nobody seemed too interested in picking up our tickets.
Yeah.
So we decided to stay home.
Okay. Okay. We've talked a little bit about the book that you have just finished. Are you working on anything new since then?
I'm working on mostly short stories since then.
Okay.
As I said, I think I've written mostly short stories, and that's kind of my favorite form. and the one that comes most naturally to me, I think. And so I've been doing that since I finished Old Number 5, which is the one that is we talked about a minute ago.
Right. Now, when you write stories, do you revisit characters and situations, or are they all pretty much unique to themselves?
No, they're not. There's a certain amount of overlap sometimes, not always, but sometimes. There is the character in Devil in the Valley named Eli.
Mm-hmm.
He's a very important figure in this book, Devil in the Valley. And yeah. He's also in a couple of stories that I've been writing this year.
Oh, okay.
Same fellow. So there is that much overlap, but it's not a really, really prominent thing about the stories I write.
Now, do you have story collections?
Yeah, I have two. I have the first book I ever published was a collection of stories called The Bride of Ambrose back in the 80s. Okay. And then since then, a couple of years ago, I had another collection published called Round Mountain. It was published by the Concord Free Press in Boston.
I've heard of that. Now, is that publisher unusual?
What
do they do? I've heard of them, but...
They publish books and give them away.
Right, yeah.
Their idea is they make very, very nice, very good books, very high quality books, and then they advertise them as their idea is what they call generosity-based publishing. Mm-hmm. So you, the reader, order up a book from the Concord Free Press, like Round Mountain,
mm-hmm.
and it comes absolutely free to you. There's no cost for the book. There's no cost for the mail or anything like that. You read it and you pass it on to somebody else. And in consideration of the value that you've received, you make a contribution to some charitable, understood very broadly, effort.
Huh.
Whatever you think is fair. Maybe it's nothing. Maybe it's quite a lot. And in doing this with their books over the past, they've been around 6 or 7 years, I guess, now, they reckon they have leveraged up over $1 million worth of donations to all kinds of things based on their books.
And do they ask people to let them know where they've contributed?
Yes, they do. In the book that you get, there's two ways. You can go to their website and enter where you have given, how much, so forth, for what book. Or you can also there's a sort of a form in the book itself that you can use.
Okay, great. So do they fundraise in order to be able to afford to do this?
they're able to afford to do it because everybody works for free.
Mm.
Like, I didn't get paid anything for Round Mountain.
Mm-hmm.
And the designers, the printers, the publicity people are all volunteers. They must do fundraising as well, because the ends don't meet, even with all that volunteer effort.
Sure. But
the details I don't know.
That's a very interesting model.
They're a wonderful organization. You should really, Shayla, get them on the internet.
Yeah.
Concord Press and read all about it. They're wonderful. They say their line is publishing good books is fun, selling them isn't, so we skip that part.
That's great. All right, talking about good books, I was going to ask next if you've read anything lately that you particularly enjoyed that you would recommend to listeners.
Oh, yes. I have. For the past 3 months, I've been reading War and Peace. I had read it years and years and years ago, but I found a new translation, which is much better than the one that I read before. And so I have been plugging through there, and it's a bit of a slog, but there's nothing like it that I think of.
Yeah.
So I've been reading that with great pleasure. I'll be sorry when it's done.
You've read it once before, you don't come back to it every few years or something.
No, I haven't. I've only read it once before, and I liked it then too, but I'm enjoying it much more this time around. I'm not sure why, but there are these wonderful set pieces. That author, he seems to know about everything. I mean, he's got the Napoleonic Wars going on. He's got the miserable conditions in the hospital, and then he's got aristocratic ladies preparing for a ball in St. Petersburg, and the sweep of it all is extraordinary.
Yeah. Okay, wonderful. I just have one last question for you, Castle. Sure. I want to talk a little bit about your authorial voice, which I feel is different than the narrative point of view or the characters' voices. You use rhythm and repetition in your work, I think, to great effect. And if you can suffer another reading of mine, I do have a little example that we could then talk
sure.
about.
Yes,
okay.
Please.
There's a character named Lucas. He's a young man who's having some issues in school and some troubles. So he gets hired to come to Taft's house and help him paint his house. So Lucas was sweating. He didn't know what he was into here. He didn't know how to paint houses. He didn't want to paint houses. He didn't know what he wanted. He did know that he was at the end of some kind of road, or anyway, he was at a fork. He knew more than that. He knew he needed not to fail. He knew that the hard surface he could feel behind him pressing against his shoulder blades and his butt was a wall. He thought maybe it was the wall. So, you know, and I liked that section. I read it over a number of times. And there, you know, I find this in your work. There's sometimes you'll get into sort of a kind of hypnotic rhythm that's very pleasurable to read and brings a lot of meaning. And I wondered if we can just talk a little bit about that. And also if maybe you have any advice for writers who might be listening as to how authors can find their own voice.
I'm conscious of repetitions being a much more important thing in the writing that I do than it used to be. I think it's very interesting to me as I'm writing away to see how much repetition is too much.
Mm-hmm.
And I go back and forth from version to version of things. I did in the case of that bit you just read about Lucas. But I think that what repetition does in writing is something that I had never thought about too much. But it's certainly as important as word choice or vocabulary, and can have all kinds of effects that you wouldn't expect.
Yeah.
Especially in emphasizing things and aspects of things. It's a question of emphasis, really. Repetition makes emphasis. And I think, I didn't set out to write my last few books with the idea, okay, this time there's going to be more repetition. It just kind of came along.
Yeah.
And having recognized that it's there, I'm very, very intrigued and interested in going on with it. I think that there have been writers, other writers, who have noticed the same thing, especially Twain.
Mm-hmm.
Twain, of course, was a speaker as well as a writer. He performed his writings. And that, he has quite a bit to say about how important repetition is for that kind of writing. But it's also important in mine, too.
Yeah.
I should say.
So something that you just said makes me think that sort of leads neatly into the other part of my question about how authors can find their own voice. And it sounds like it just happens to you if you keep writing.
That's been my experience. It did to me.
Yeah.
And it's the most exciting thing you can imagine. But I don't know how to tell somebody to do it other than just as you just said, to keep writing and keep reading.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Wonderful. I'm going to just mention again, the name of the novel is The Devil in the Valley. It's a novel by Castle Freeman Jr. It's published by Overlook Press and Duckworth Press, I guess, in
Duckworth Publishers.
Duckworth Publishers in England, is that?
Yes, they're in London. They are the I think that Duckworth and Overlook have the same ownership,
Okay.
but they're separate companies.
Okay. So, Castle, it was a great pleasure to talk to you again, and I wish you all the best with your next book.
Okay, thank you, Shayla. It's very nice of you to invite me. I'm complimented. I'm honored. Thank you.
That again was a conversation with Castle Freeman Jr. You can learn more about his work at his website, castlefreemanjr.com. This week's Write the Book prompt is to experiment with rhythm and repetition in your own work. Good luck with your work in the coming week, and please listen next week for another prompt or suggestion. If you're interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, let them know that archived episodes of Write the Book are available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and Write the Book Radio Show on Facebook for updates. You can also access the podcast at my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com. I'm very happy to announce that the show will have a new broadcast home as of February. Write the Book is going to start airing on the new Burlington station WBTV 99.3 on Mondays at 3 p.m. It's going to be a two-hour time slot, actually. The first hour will be our regular show, and then the second hour is probably going to feature some reruns and possibly other new content as yet to be designed. Tune in or stream the show live starting on February 6th at 3. If you have a guest to suggest, or comments about the show, or news about book-related events, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. And if you like the show, please rate it in iTunes, like it on Facebook, and tell all your friends. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro, and you've been listening to Write the Book. Have a great week.